Again, our first instructor today is going to be Mark Howard from the EPA's Office of Emergency Management, and everyone should be starting on slide number one. Mark, are you ready?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you just fine. Go ahead.
Okay, great. I'd like to welcome everyone to the seminar today. We're kind of excited in using this technology. It's a kind of a first for us to do this particular format, but one of the things I would like to right up front, we would really appreciate your feedback on statistics and how this works out, because we would like to utilize this as a mechanism to do some specific sector-type presentations down the road. This is a first in a number of things we're going to be doing for outreach on the SPCC rule. We're very excited, I know from the staff that has been working on this, to get to a point where we're kind of finishing up the rule amendments, beginning implementation, and really focusing on outreach, and this is the beginning of that effort. Again, please give us any feedback you had. As mentioned on the beginning of the call, there are two of our national experts with me on today. Patty Jeffrey is there in D.C. I'm actually out with one of our regional inspectors, Richard Franklin, who's on the phone, and we're out here in San Francisco teaching future inspectors that will be coming out and working with you guys on compliance and doing inspections in the future. So we're excited to get started. And what I will do is, because of some of the complications associated with the compliance date and some of the things that have happened associated with that compliance date and the extension of the dates of the 2008 rules effective date, I will stop to specifically answer any questions regarding those issues several slides in. But if you could hold your detailed questions toward the end, because then I will go through all the provisions and give you a little bit more insight on what we've done in this 2009 action. So with that, I'm on slide one. You should be on a slide that says FPCC rule amendments, clue in. And what I'm going to say is slide. Instead of advance every slide, because I'll be talking a lot. So when I say slide, that means move forward. So let's get started. So move to your next slide. Okay, just an overview real quick. The SPCC rule, this is just an overview of what we're going to be talking about today. I'm going to talk about the 2008-2009 amendments, give you a little bit of background on what happened. There was a considerable number of phone calls. Patty, myself, and the regions can tell you about a little bit of the confusion going on with these two rule actions and how they relate to each other. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, give you a timeline, and try to put this in perspective so it makes sense. And then in a separate section, we'll talk about the compliance dates, which are the dates you need to, you know, comply with the rule provisions that have been updated since 2002. We'll go into the final rule amendments, which are considerable in length. This is probably the bulk of the presentation, give you some detailed information about those. And then in the fourth section, again, we're really interested in starting some of the outreach and implementation on the rule, give you some additional information regarding reporting relative to 110 as well as 112. So with that slide. And just so you know, there's a delay on my end, so it's going to take me a second to pop up. Slide. Okay, a little bit about the SPCC rule, just for the purposes of making sure everyone's on the same slide. You should be on slide four that says SPCC. What we have is a rule that goes back some time. It was one of the first rules issued by the agency in the early 70s. It's referred to as the SPCC rule, but it's actually technically called the Oil Pollution Prevention Regulation. It resides in the Code of Federal Regulations in 40 CFR Part 12. It includes the other large program that we have at EPA on oil spill prevention and response and preparedness, which is the FRP, or Facility Response Planning Regulation. The best way to kind of distinguish between the two, the SPCC rule is kind of the rule that you use as a facility operator to prevent the genie from getting out of the bottle, or when the genie gets out of the bottle, those things that you're going to do on your facility to prevent the discharge from leaving. And then finally, those preparedness measures, inspections, integrity testing items that you're going to do to prevent a discharge. The FRP is more along the lines of once a discharge has occurred and it is leaving your property and is reaching navigable waters, that is the plan to respond to that spill that has reached navigable waters. I misspoke. I just want to make sure it's 40 CFR Part 112, not 12. I misspoke. So with that being said, what's the purpose? It's very basic. When you look at the actual law, it's a very short piece of the Federal Water Pollution Control Act, or otherwise known as the Clean Water Act. It basically says the agency has a responsibility to issue regulations for facilities to prevent oil spills. And what we have done is developed a rule that essentially is a performance-based rule with the goal of preventing spills from reaching navigable waters. Now, as you know, certain facilities are required to develop SPCC plans that describe the things you're going to do and the structures that are in place to do exactly that, to prevent those discharges of oil. There's been some changes of recent. It used to be that these all were required to be PE certified. There are now some opportunities for smaller facilities to self-certify their SPCC plan. Slide. Okay, my computer just went down. I'm going to switch to another computer. Got a little technical difficulty at the hotel, not a big deal. You should be on the slide that says 2008-2009 amendments and compliance date timeline. Is that the correct slide, moderator? Because my computer just went down, the internet.
That's correct.
Okay, great. I'm going to try to get my internet back up, but of course it's never easy with the SPCC rule, as you know. Okay, so with that, the October 15th date that you see on the timeline, the reason why we have this here is essentially to give you a feel for those dates and how they fit together on this rather confusing and the numerous number of actions that have occurred since October of 2007. October 15th, 2007, we essentially had a proposal for what was coined as SPCC2. Now, as you all are aware, we essentially had a set of revisions in 2006, which we won't go over in detail today, but the bottom line is we then came out with what was SPCC2, October 15th, 2007, and then took comment on that proposal. December 5th of 2008, we published this action in the Federal Register. February 3rd, 2009, we delayed the effective date. Now, I'll talk about why we did that, but essentially the December action was going to go into effect sometime after the new administration came into office, and as a result of that, we had to extend the effective date. And I'll go into some detail of how that works. So the bottom line is, as a result of notice and comment on the 2008 provisions, which were put out back for comment in February, we decided to extend that effective date again till January 14, 2010. The reason being is we were compelled to look at the regulation and look at the comments that we received, and essentially what we wanted to do is we back calculated the amount of time that was needed to advance a new rule action from going backwards from the January date. So basically it gave us enough time to go through the regulatory process. The goal was to get the rule out November 9 of 2009, which we met. What essentially happened, and this is the short version, is the 2009 rule made some changes to the 2008 rule, and they both will go effective on January 14, 2010. So they will go effective on the same day, and the 2009 rule will effectively change the 2008 rule in the areas that I will highlight later in the presentation. Currently, we have a compliance date of November 10th, 2010, and we'll talk about what that means later in the presentation. Here's the layout. Now let's go into a little bit of the details. Slide. On 2008, 2008, the rule amendments were published in the FR, as I mentioned, December 5th. We originally were scheduled to go into effect February 3rd, 2009. Now, essentially what happened was, as you can see, that date is after the new administration came, there was a change in administration, excuse me, and essentially what we were required to do is we looked at changing some of these requirements or based on notice and comment. So essentially, again, this action in 2008 was in response to what was called the Thompson Report, and basically it was an action to provide relief in certain areas, production, farming, and to do some additional items that were required in the to kind of clean up the 2006 rule of sorts. Slide. The purpose was to the purpose of these amendments were essentially to raise a number of issues that we received from the regulated community. We got quite a bit of feedback post 2002 on the rule. This was the second effort to make things clearer, to codify some of the things that we had done in guidance, improve clarity, streamline requirements in certain areas, and facilitate compliance for owners and operators. Slide. And good news, our internet's back up. Okay, so what we had to do then is, and it's just a personal story, but it was interesting. I was watching the inauguration, and one of those little scroll lines across CNN said that there was this, the first memo out of the White House was about rulemakings, and I knew that it was going to impact the FPCC rule. And it was interesting in that it impacted us in two different ways because we had two different actions, one being the 2008 rule, and then we had another extension, which I'll talk about later. Well, when that came out, we were provided guidance by both the White House and OMB on what to do with rules that had been printed in the Federal Register, which is this is the case with the 2008 action, had not gone final. And essentially what we did is we delayed the effective date of the 2008 rule 60 days. The reason why we did that is after meeting with the administrator, and by the way, you don't want to be the first person that gets to meet with the administrator about something, and we were that lucky group. But the 2008 rule was discussed by the administrator, and a decision was made to put the rule out in its entirety for public comment. Based on President Obama's directive of being transparent, it was felt this was the appropriate thing to do with this action, and so we did go out with notice and comment on the entire rule. However, at the request of the administrator, there were three specific provisions that were pointed out in addition to receiving comment on the entire rule that were associated with some of the production facility relief. As a result of that action, we received about 55 public comments, a variety of comments from all sectors, including NGOs, concerned citizens, industry, and kind of a mixed feelings about the rule and what we had done. Slide. As a result of that, in reviewing the comments that we got, we had to make a decision as to what we were going to do next. And essentially what we decided is, as I mentioned earlier, we felt that it was appropriate to go through the rulemaking process again, and this became the genesis of the 2009 action, which was basically response to the comments we received on the 2008 action. But to allow this to happen, we had to calculate the time period needed to go through the process and came up with the January 14th, 2010 date. One of the other interesting things for doing this over the years, some of you will notice that we like to do things on holidays. And, of course, on April 1st, Fool's Day, we published an action that delayed the effective date till January 14th, 2010. The reason why we did this, it gave us time to go through the process, and then public comment was requested, and there is a typo in this slide, and it's kind of ironic because it got past all of us, and it was one of the reasons why we had problems early on, but it should say public comment was requested on whether a further delay of the effective date was warranted, because we delay effective dates, not extend them. But anyway, that being said, we delayed the effective date, and slide. 2009, essentially this is the package we worked on during that time period, and what we were trying to do is look at finalizing some of the 2008 requirements that made sense, and made no changes on them. Another thing that occurred in this 2009 action was we removed provisions from the 2008 rule. And then third, we had some technical corrections to make to the rule regarding preamble as well as Appendix G, which had some issues when the Word file was translated into the Federal Register. A lot of things were dropped, and we had to make some corrections there. Slide. In front of you is a list, a rather lengthy list, of all the amendments that were finalized without change. So if you're familiar with what the 2008 rule said, these were the things that kind of stayed exactly the same. So the 2009 action, you'll see that basically we say, we address comment, and we say, well, we're going to, in a nutshell, keep things the way they are. And this is important for folks on the call, what it typically does is unless there was a change in some preamble text, we typically refer you back to the 2008 rule to get the details of the preamble. So that's important, and you need to know that relationship when you're looking at the 2008 and 2009 amendments side by side. So for an example, if you wanted to learn more about hot mix asphalt and the preamble, you really should be going back to 2008 because that's where the bulk of the preamble language resides. Okay, so this long list includes an exemption from hot mix asphalt, exemption for pesticide application containers. I will go into detail in later slides on these, an exemption for certain USTs, heating oil containers, some things that we had to do relative to farm nurse tanks and how they associate with our mobile refueler relief. We amended the definition of facility, revised the facility diagram to provide relief. And flexibility on how to document the types of containers at your facility. We provided a loading rack definition and made some changes to that particular section. We modified the secondary containment requirements for 112.7c, exempted certain non-transportation trucks from the size containment requirements, simplified security and integrity testing, and amended the integrity testing for animal fats and vegetable oils. Slide. Again, without change, we amended the definition of production facility, clarified kind of a housekeeping issue with 112.9 and who was subject to the provisions of the production section. We exempted certain interfacility gathering lines at production facilities, provided prescriptive requirements for flow lines and interfacility gathering lines, provided an alternative compliance option for flow through process vessels. This was at production facilities. Provided an alternative compliance option for size containment for produced water containers. We also provided, and this was one, we got a lot of comment over the years over this, and this made perfectly good sense, was to give a option relative to containment for flow and gathering lines. We have a feeling this particular option is going to be utilized by quite a number of folks out there in the oil patch. We defined a produced water container, clarified the definition of enclosed, and then clarified the applicability of the SPCC, term man-made structures and wind turbines. And I'll talk about how that comes to play in a little bit. Slide. Okay, as an overview, we also made some technical corrections to language that was associated with a particular exemption for underground storage tank at nuclear facilities. Clarified some corrections and got rid of some typos associated with the Appendix G or Tier 1 template, and I already mentioned that, but that was, some translation errors that we had to fix. The compliance date for new facilities was also a change to align with the current compliance date of November 10th, 2010. Slide. Okay, we won't talk about these in detail as they've been removed, but just for accounting purposes, the items that were removed from the rule was an exclusion for oil production facilities and farms from loading and unloading rack requirements. The reason why we did that is essentially we've created a definition. Typically farms and production facilities won't meet that definition, but the bottom line is the definition itself will determine whether you have a loading or unloading rack. We don't need an exclusion. The second thing was an alternative qualified facilities eligibility criteria for an oil production. That was removed from the regulation. And the third and final thing removed from the 2008 provisions by the new 2009 provisions was an exemption for certain produced water containers. In this case, a PE was able to make a container-by-container exemption of certain produced water containers. That was also removed from the rule. Slide. Okay, the effective date. This is a pretty straightforward slide, and it says what I've said before, which is 2008 requirements will essentially go into effect on January 14th, 2010. Now, the effective date, again, has nothing to do with the compliance date. It's just when those two actions will be effective. And as you can see, they're on the same date, so the 2009 changes will modify the 2008 code, and then come the end of the year, it will reconcile itself. When you see the printed version of the code, the current version is a green version of the book printed in July of 2009. And just as a, those of you that don't know of this, there is a what's called ECFR, which does a electronic reconciliation of that on a daily basis, which is kind of a neat tool that you should utilize in lieu of that printed version that comes out only once a year in July. Slide. Compliance date slide. You can go to the next one. Slide. Okay, you should be on a slide that says compliance dates. This is important, and there's kind of a the wording in here. I want to be crystal clear about this first bullet because it could be a little bit confusing. Compliance dates refer to the deadline in which an owner operator must basically comply with those requirements, and it's really from the 2002 rule on. There were significant changes in 2002. 2006 was mainly relief, creating qualified facilities, Tier 2 qualified facilities or self-certified plans and some other things. And then, of course, these 2008-2009 actions. Basically, this date is the date that your facility is required to update its plan to the changes that go all the way back to 2002. The delay of the effective date, that piece that we just talked about, there was a lot of confusion that January 14th was the compliance date. That is not the compliance date. That is actually the date the two rules go into effect. So the compliance date, and I believe it's on the next slide. Slide. Let's talk about that compliance date. I mentioned there was two actions that the agency had kind of in the hopper, and the second one, we had the 2008 amendments, and we also had a final rule to amend the compliance dates for the SPCC rule in January. Based on guidance from the White House and from OMB, since this action had not been published in the Federal Register, then we withdrew that action. And then in June 19th of 2009, realizing there was an compliance date arriving of July of this year, published an additional extension of November 10th, 2010. But one important clarification in this is that this included all facilities, including farms. So everyone now has the same compliance date of November 10th, 2010. So along those lines, as a result of some of the negotiations at OMB and concerns, again, about some of the confusion, we have certainly heard from the phone calls that we received and emails, all the confusion about compliance dates versus effective dates and what am I supposed to do. In the November 2009 action, the agency committed to proposing an additional extension of the compliance date. So again, while the current compliance date is November 10th, 2010, and again, the reason why that was picked, that would have given you one full year from the November date this year we published to put your, to get your plan in order. We said that we're going to give you, well, we are going to print an action to propose an extension that would possibly move that date forward. Slide. Okay, this is an extremely important slide. It says compliance dates for all facilities, and it has a yellow border saying a facility starting operation must. If you're on that slide, this is an important slide. So this is the big question. What do I have to do? For facilities that were in operation on August 16th, 2002, on or before 2002, basically you are currently maintaining your existing SPCC plan, and you must amend or implement that plan no later than November 10th, 2010. Now, again, remember, there is there's some intent by the agency to publish a proposal to possibly move that date. But right now, that is the compliance date. If you're a facility that started operation between August 16, 2002 through November 10, 2010, you basically have no SPCC requirements, and you must prepare and implement your plan by November 10, 2010. Now, along those lines, of course, we would recommend you, you know, get started looking at, you know, the things you need to do to comply, because that date will roll up on you fairly quickly. And there's a number of things associated, especially on the integrity testing side, that planning ahead will certainly help you in the process of complying with the new provisions of the 2002 code on. So again, if you were in operation, you really, after that August 16th date, you're just kind of in a wait mode, and you have to update your plan and implement it by November 10th, 2010. After November 10th, 2010, you must prepare or implement an SPCC plan before beginning operations. Now, this has one important exception. That is that production facilities, new production facilities that go into operation after that November date, are allowed an extra 6 months. As a result of the relief package that we put together for production facilities, we received some very good and compelling comments about the reasons to give an extra 6 months to allow production operations to stabilize, and more importantly, to encourage the idea of green completions, in that there's a lot of tanks that coming in and out of the production operation in that first 6 months that would require multiple amendments to your plan. So it made sense to give these particular facilities an extra 6 months because of their unique characteristics. Slide. Okay, I'm going to start there just for a couple of minutes and a couple of questions, and I'll let the moderator take over from that point to answer any questions specifically on the compliance date or the effective date, if we can do that. Does that make
sense? Sure, that's fine. Right now, we don't have any questions that were submitted online at this point. Just a reminder for those of you that are streaming the audio or are looking at the slides online, you want to have the pop-up blocker on your computer turned off and click on the question mark icon and have a new window that will pop up, and you can type up your comments and questions at any time. Those of you who are on the phone lines, if you do have a comment or question, you can take your phone off of mute, either use the local mute button if you press that, or hit pound 6 to take your phone off of mute and just go ahead and ask a question verbally.
Any questions?
I think you've been doing a fine job.
I don't know about that. I think they're just overwhelmed with our complex set of issues here. Okay, wait a minute.
Looks like there's a question. Go ahead.
You've talked about the proposed extension to the dates. Is there any expectation for, A, when that proposal will be defined or published for us?
Well, don't want to get into our scheduling right now, but I can tell you it's an extremely high priority for us, and we're working on it right now. So I would imagine you would see something coming out in summer.
So we
but
would see.
Yeah, don't hold me to that because you know, again, it's, you know, maybe a little bit earlier, maybe a little bit later. But the bottom line is, it's, we're working on it right now. Okay, Let's move on. You should be on a slide. It says Section 3, Final Amendments. These final amendments, we're going to go into some detail and tell you about these amendments. And just for the purpose of this slide, to be technically correct, a lot of these are 2008 amendments that haven't been changed, but what we're talking about is the way these two rules work together, what you have to deal with now, and that's what we're going over. So let's advance slide, and you should be on a slide that says hot mixed asphalt, everyone's favorite. Essentially what we did here is hot mixed asphalt, for those of you that don't know, is the mixture of aggregate and AC or asphalt cement. And we exempted half hot mixed asphalt and their containers, SPCC rule. Now, this is a twofold exemption, as most exemptions are in the SPCC rule, meaning that, one, it is not counted towards the applicability for your capacity calculation, and then once the facility is regulated, it's not subject to the SPCC requirements. We felt that it was reasonable because basically this is road material, and we were not, we did not feel it was appropriate to apply the SPCC regulations to roads. Slide. Okay, the next one. As a result of working with farming community, and again, I should at this time mention our lead on this is Troy Swackhammer. He's been, you know, kind of working the effort with Department of Agriculture and some other folks here at EPA. Some unique things came up to relative to the farming, and one of the things was pesticide application equipment. You might ask yourself why that would be subject to the SPCC rule. Well, a lot of pesticides and herbicides are mixed with an adjuvant oil, and the oil being mixed with that pesticide for the purposes of SPCC then makes that something that potentially could be regulated under the rule. After reviewing requirements elsewhere associated with FIFRA, we decided it was appropriate to provide an exemption for this and did so. So the exemption applies to the application equipment itself, ground boom applicators, air spray applicators, some aircraft, and more importantly, the related mixed containers. Some folks will mix this up in large batches and add the adjuvant oil to the pesticide, and that container for mixing the material is exempt. The only time that we would regulate is if you took the adjuvant oil and pesticide, mixed it, and then stored it on site and you didn't apply it. Then we would consider that bulk storage of oil. Slide. Residential heating oil containers. This was a rather interesting change that, again, was mainly initiated by looking at the work Troy looked at with farms and how certain farms were being, you know, triggering thresholds based on just heating oil containers at the farm residence or the home residence at a farm. But then we began to look at this a little bit more globally. We received comments saying, you know, we should look at this not just at farms, we should look at this at all single family residences. And so we did. And what we provided is an exemption, again, twofold exemption to both the applicability calculation and the rule requirements for residential heating oil tanks. This applies whether they're above or below ground, or in our rule, we use the term completely buried. They need to be located at a farm or single-family residence. They're used, essentially, they're holding the heating oil tank for that residence, and that's essentially why we wanted to exempt them, is when we look back at the code dating to 73, the original 660 and 1320 were multiples of the existing typical container size for heating oil tanks, and it was clear from the intent of 73 that really we were not trying to regulate home heating oil tanks, and became the genesis of the rationale to provide this exemption. If it's non-residential, a commercial building, and it's a heating oil container, the regulations still apply. Slide. This, and I noted there are a couple of our stakeholders out in the power industry that are on the call, even from my home state of Virginia, the Dominion folks, that's all they're on here. The UST, there are certain, and it's kind of a complicated matter, but the short way to explain this is that the SPCC rule typically does not regulate underground storage tanks because we exempt them, and this was in the 2002 action. But there are certain tanks that are not regulated by 280 or 281, those that are either exempted or deferred, that would fall back into the SPCC regs. One set of those containers was underground storage tanks at these nuclear power generation facilities. Essentially, they are deferred under 280. They supply power for diesel generators at these nuclear facilities and meet a very rigorous NRC design criteria. As one could imagine, you don't want these tanks failing, and the requirements for the particular containers are extremely stringent. So we felt it was appropriate to allow them to be exempt from the rule because the NRC requirements are so comprehensive. It, again, only applies to these particular tanks at NRC facilities. It does not apply to other containers at nuclear power generation facilities. So, in other words, if there was some other type of petroleum storage, they're not exempt. It's only these specific underground storage tanks. Slide. Okay, this is a very important amendment clarification. Essentially, what we did here is we were looking at the definition of facility. When we were in the work group looking at this, I mean, it was pretty clear to our council that, you know, that there's a lot of flexibility built into the term facility, but we wanted to highlight that. The reason being is there's a lot of concerns for on the production sector and on the farming sector on how they would be able to define their facility. And this is essentially signaling from the agency the flexibility in that definition for you, the owner-operator, to determine what your facility is in a reasonable fashion. So the first thing that we had to do was a matter of housekeeping. As a result of the litigation associated with production facilities, we wanted to make it clear that the term facility was the governing term for SPCC applicability. What that means is, essentially, there was some confusion in the field about what particular production facilities, how they would be subject to the rule. And there was interpretations being made that in a geographical area, owner that had many wells or many tank batteries was by the code required to be consolidated into one facility. What we say here is that is not the case. The term production facility is in the rule only to provide guidance on the types of facilities that are subject to 112.9, the production requirements. And essentially, in the preamble language associated with facility, you'll see that. We have discussion of that particular relationship to production facilities, but term facility is what defines your applicability under this rule, which is determined by you, the facility owner operator. You have the discretion to identify things, your facility based on certain factors, whether contiguous or non-contiguous properties, buildings. We added the terms parcels, leases, to try to tie into some of the words that are commonly used in the oil patch as well as in the farming community. Essentially, what we were trying to do here is, again, explain that there are many opportunities for facilities to reasonably divide their operations up in a way that makes sense for them regarding their SPCC compliance burden. Some people may want to maintain one large facility. For example, in the oil patch, if you want to put several tank batteries under one facility, that's fine. What we would caution you is, by doing that and putting a big box around multiple tank batteries, you create two potential issues for yourself. One, if the capacities are large enough, you may trigger the FRP requirements. The other thing it triggers is any kind of gathering systems between those facilities become interfacility piping that EPA would regulate. So, again, the choice is up to you. You may decide to break those batteries into individual facilities. Same with farms. Again, farming, an example would be you have chicken coops in one area, and then in another parcel you have irrigation for corn. You may consider those as two separate facilities. That's an example. Again, each of these are site-specific. What we don't think would be reasonable is taking a facility like a bulk terminal, and if you had four tanks, calling each tank a facility. Slide. Okay, what you have in front of you is the rule text with red indicating the areas where we added text. Again, you'll see right up front that the terms property, parcel, and lease were added. Again, try to get some meaning relative to the farming and production sector. And at the end is the real clarification language. It says continuous or non-contiguous buildings, properties, parcels, leases, structures, installations, pipes, and pipelines under ownership of the same person may be considered separate facilities. And then the last sentence is the discussion I talked about before, which is that this definition rules applicability, not production facility. That was in response to the litigation. Slide. This particular one is dear to my heart in that where I was at EPA, I was a state inspector, and I came to their course, and like you in the regulated community, I was really confused by what EPA thought was a loading rack, and little did I know that they hired me to fix the problem that I was complaining about. So, definition of loading rack was one of the things that we worked a long time on with a number of different partners. It was at our subject to litigation. I think we've come up with a very reasonable and I think a very clear definition that, again, we got a lot of help from some particular folks in the regulated community, API, as well as looked at some European definitions to kind of put this together. And so what we did is we put together a definition, and then we made some tweaks to the language because there was some confusion, too, about loading racks and areas, and basically what we did is we wanted to make it clear that the 112.7H provisions apply to loading racks, not to loading areas. The difference, and it would be worthwhile to stop here, is if your transfer area is not defined as a loading rack, you will see that we typically call them a transfer or loading or unloading area. The significant difference is in the containment requirements between a loading rack having a size requirement as well as some additional inspection and testing requirements, well, inspection requirements associated with the loading rack in the vehicle, whereas a transfer area would only need to meet the general containment requirements of 112.7C. Okay, so next slide. You'll see on this a picture of a typical loading or unloading rack. The definition we've provided is a loading rack means a fixed structure such as a platform or gangway necessary for loading or unloading a tank car, tank truck, which is located at a facility subject to the requirements of this part. A loading rack includes a loading or unloading arm. This is a significant and important point. As a matter of fact, we have been beating it into the folks' heads here. In the course that we're teaching right now, we are instructing people, you're looking for a loading or unloading arm. Now, in addition, there may be some additional equipment that we would look for, piping assemblages, valves, pumps, shutoff devices, overfill sensors, and certain safety devices. Slide. Loading arm. This is a busy slide, but it is important just because we want to be crystal clear about what the loading arm is, because it's such a key part of that definition. A loading arm is a moving piping assemblage that essentially may be a mixture of solid and flexible piping. There's a lot of comments saying, you know, flex hose needs to be out. Well, if you're familiar with bottom loading an MC306-46 tanker truck is done with a bottom loading arm that has a, both a combination of flex tube and steel tube, whereas top loaders are typically strictly steel tube with a swivel joint. But what we're looking at here is basically this loading arm that has some kind of a swivel that's connected in a way that allows you to move this thing to either top or bottom load the vehicle, and it may be a tank car or a rail car. Again, since we had tremendous concerns about this flexible hosing issue, we went into a lot of detail saying, hey, look, there, in some cases, and specifically bottom loading, there may be a combination of flex piping and rigid piping that's connected by a swivel joint. But what we are crystal clear in the preamble is that if you have a hose that goes from the vehicle, tanker truck, rail car, into a what I would call an offloading position, pump back position, or some industry terms, that doesn't have a loading arm, that is considered a transfer area. Now that's significant for some of the stakeholders like PMAA, those facilities that have smaller inventories that are filling shop-built tanks via an 18-wheeler that comes from a larger terminal. That loading position from the where the tanker truck comes in and loads, if it's just by hose, no loading rack present, is only subject to the general provisions for containment. Slide. And, moderator, my slides froze up. I don't know if everyone else's did.
It's possible that it's a local internet connection on your end. My recommendation is probably going to be to revert back to the paper copies that you had available, if you can. Just as a time check for you, you're about halfway through, and we've got about an hour left total.
Okay, great. Okay, along those lines, they're back up. You got a picture in front of you, which is a loading or unloading arm. And essentially what we have there is a picture of that loading or unloading arm, and that's what we're instructing our folks to look for as a piece of equipment on a loading rack. Slide. Okay, Tier 1 qualified facilities. Just as a going back to 2006 action, we defined qualified facilities in 2006 as facilities that had 10,000 gallons or less above ground storage, and met a certain spill criteria. And what that allowed was a self-certified plan. What we did in this 2008/9 action was we created a tier under that, which was Tier 1 qualified facilities, which was a very streamlined SPCC plan that is contained in Appendix G to the rule. You must first qualify as a Tier 2 facility to be a Tier 1 facility. We'll talk about what qualifying factor you have to meet to be a Tier 1 facility. So again, we, in the 2008-2009 action, streamlined these requirements, removed some of the things in the SPCC rule, and created a template of certification. Slide. What's the eligibility? Essentially, the first part is should be familiar. That is the Tier 2 qualifying criteria, which is 10,000 gallons or less in aggregate, and this is very important, above-ground storage capacity. Only look at above-ground storage capacity when you're looking at the eligibility criteria for meeting the self-certification, either Tier 2 or Tier 1. And you basically have a clean spill history. You look back 3 years from your certification date, and you determine whether or not you've had a single discharge of oil greater than 1,000 gallons that exceeded 42 gallons within a 12-month period. That's not within a year. It's a rolling month. So those criteria are used to give you the Tier 2 status. You may become a Tier 1 status facility if your facility has no individual above-ground oil container with a capacity greater than 5,000 gallons. So essentially what we're looking at is very, very simple facilities with very limited piping that would qualify and use this template. Okay, so with a Tier 1 slide, you should be on Tier 1 requirements, just as a point of reference. The option to complete this is, like Tier 2, it's an option. You can do this in lieu of a self-certified plan by an engineer. You can do this in lieu of Tier 2. A Tier 1 facility can still do a Tier 2 plan or do a full-blown SPCC plan with SPTs. Again, the choice is up to you. One of the things that Tier 1 facilities be aware of is that if in the Tier 2 criteria, this is the one that is not using Appendix G, we allow the use of a hybrid plan. And what essentially that is that's where a PE comes in and certifies certain sections. A Tier 1 facility cannot use a hybrid plan format. So if a Tier 1 facility wanted that flexibility, they would have to go to the Tier 2 format, which basically is all the rule. It doesn't give you the template in Appendix G. It is a very basic design, very simple. I know that there was a lot of concern because we had pulled the original template off the rule. That was for in 2008. That was for a reason. As I explained earlier, there were technical errors in that template that if you would have filled out, you would have not been in compliance with the intended rule provision. So what we did is we modified that to correct those typos in 2009, and we've taken a look, and it looks like the translation to the FR is correct, and we're in good shape as far as the content of Appendix G. Just as a quick point of departure, we know that there is tremendous interest in getting these things in a format that can be manipulated by the folks there in the field, and we are currently working to have the templates up in a Word format, Adobe format, and some other options fairly soon. We're hoping before the holidays, maybe a little bit after. So back to slide 33. The template currently can be found in Appendix G. It's a very simple plan. Modifies and eliminates certain requirements that we, as we went through the rule, know you would not have, or things that you would not have, requirements didn't make sense at these small facilities. A prime example would be loading racks. You are not going to have a loading rack at a 5,000-gallon facility because that would be a really bad distribution operation, but it wouldn't really make sense. But that would be an example of one of the requirements that was reduced. The other one, which is a big one, is the elimination of the facility diagram. As I mentioned, you are limited in Tier 1. You cannot use, as in Tier 2, unless you have a PE. But in Tier 1, you are not allowed to use EE or environmental equivalents. You are not allowed to use or maintain an impracticability determination. You are not allowed to use any of the provisions where a PE certification is required. Now, this has particular interest in the upstream sector because of the produced water compliance option for skimming that we'll be talking about later. That requires a PE certification. A Tier 1 facility would not be able to utilize that, but could bump up to Tier 2 and use it in a hybrid format. Okay, slide. The summary, just a quick sheet of what I went over. Probably no need to go over that again. Read it on your leisure, cut it on your wall, or cut it out, put it on your wall. But this is the criteria that we just went over in a simple format. Slide. Okay, revisions to oil production facilities. Essentially what we did is a lot of streamlining in areas where we received comment on production facilities and provide a number of options. There's a list summarizing those here, and we're going to go into the details of each one of these, so I'm not going to repeat it. As I mentioned, we did remove the alternative qualifying criteria for production facilities, and we also removed the exemption for certain produced water containers. Slide. The definition of production facility. Again, this relates to that slide on facility. And essentially, we explain in the preamble, and again, on this particular provision, you want to go back to the 2008 preamble. What we talk about is the relationship of production facility and facility. And again, this specifically has meaning relative to when you're looking at the rule and determining where your additional requirements are in the rule, that's why we define production facility. That is to show which facilities are subject to 112.9. Another thing that was highlighted in notes and comment that is of interest to the animal fat and vegetable oil producers around the country, they were concerned that there was some confusion relative to production and that there was application to animal fat and vegetable oil facilities. And in preamble, we were very clear that definition of production facilities has terms that you typically would not see in animal fat and vegetable oils. Least of all would be an oil or gas field as part of the definition. So this definition does not apply to animal fat and vegetable oil, and in their terms, production. It only applies to the petroleum upstream sector. The revision, again, links the consistency between production and the definition of facility and clarifies, again, flexibility on the boundary. What it basically says is that, you know, when you're looking at these things, the geographical area does not lock you into being a facility. So if you have multiple leases on in one geographical area on a single owner, you are not forced by the rule to call that a facility. However, you have the choice to do that. Slide. Where are we? Okay, definition of production facility. Again, just to show you the language that we've added, we wanted to be very clear on the types of things that we regulate at production facilities. So we added the word intra-facility gathering lines, and again, that was for only those lines that are inside a facility. That's a limiting term, so that should be somewhat good news. The other things that we added was we mentioned the word condensate. The reason why we mentioned this is we've gotten considerable comment about whether or not gas facilities are regulated by the FPCC provisions. In the case of a gas production facility, if it is a wet gas facility that is storing condensate on the site, we feel through this definition, and this definition would define that as a production facility. And that condensate, if it was stored in a capacity that broke a threshold, would then be, that facility would be required to address the oil portions of the facility. We do not regulate the gas or the gas at the facility. And again, finally, the language at the end basically saying that this really tells you where to go in the rule for your requirements. Again, when you're looking at applicability of the rule, once you decide that you're in, the general requirements under 112.7 apply to everyone. And then, at that point on, you're looking at a facility type and oil type to determine your specific requirements. This definition is intended to make sure folks in the production sector get to 112.9. Slide. Okay, the first thing that we added, this is a really good fix. We got a lot of feedback from the upstream sector and felt this was a very good fix. This is an example where we got a lot of really good comment from the upstream sector and a very good justification and rationale providing an extra 6 months after startup. And essentially what the rationale here is that you have a lot of containers moving in and out of that production facility that first 6 months until the operation stabilized. And by doing that, it allows them not to have to deal with amending the plan. As I mentioned earlier, it also encourages the idea of green completion, which is trying to use containers to store the fluids and things associated with that initial drilling process in containers as opposed to pits. So, again, to encourage that as well as make things a little bit easier on the upstream folks for that first 6 months, we feel it was appropriate to give them another 6 months for new production facilities. The start of operations is indicated when you start, when your wellhead begins flowing fluid through the battery. So it's at that point in time when you should have your plan is 6 months from that date. I mentioned the idea of stabilization. That was the rationale for doing this. Slide. flow lines and air facility gathering lines. While we don't define these in the rule, we do have preamble language that discusses what a flow line is versus a gathering line. Flow line is, in terms of this regulation, are those pipes, those pieces of pipe that transfer crude from the wellhead to the tank battery, and those that transfer from the tank battery to reinjection sites where you are reinjecting salt water back into the formation. What is a gathering line? A gathering line is the lines that essentially are connecting multiple tank batteries to a single location where you have injection into a pipeline or to a refinery. Slide. Okay, intra-facility and flow lines and intra-facility gathering requirements. Again, the reason why we use the term intra-facility, again, with a limiting term, to indicate the agency is only looking at piping that constitutes a gap or that performs a gathering function when you are looking at lines within a large footprint facility. Those that are inter-facility gathering lines are not regulated by EPA. They may or may not be regulated by DOT. But in lieu of the fact that there are regulations out there from DOT, and in an effort to try to minimize duplicative requirements, what we did is we looked at providing an exemption for certain gathering lines. I'm jumping to the third bullet, but the reason why I wanted to get there is this whole issue of inter-facility gathering lines versus inter-facility gathering lines. And what we've done is, if you have a facility with a large footprint that has gathering lines that are intra-facility, we have said that if you are subject to DOT regulatory requirements, now I want to be crystal clear, that does not mean statutory authority. So if there's statutory authority but no regulatory requirements for those lines, then you are still ECC. However, if you are subject to DOT regulatory requirements under 49 CFR 192 or 95, you are exempt from our rule requirements. But going back to the other issue with flow lines is a long-standing issue, which was this whole issue of providing secondary containment for these miles and miles of flow lines. Again, a very good example of where we were provided a very good rationale, regulated community, and just was the right thing to do here was to provide some options for regulatory compliance. First, want to point out that if you have provided some form of containment, which in this case is general, you're allowed to, you know, keep what you have. If you've put double-walled piping, you can keep what you have. The option that you now have with the 2008 and 2009 rule is you have the ability to not put in containment, get to essentially do a contingency plan. You have to have a written commitment of manpower, and you have to essentially make sure that your flow line maintenance program, and it's flow line and gathering line maintenance program, is such that it will allow for the detection of releases for you to implement that contingency plan. We'll talk about that in a slide or two. But the upshot is, in lieu of secondary containment, you can use a contingency plan. The important thing here is you do not have to do an impracticability claim. The agency is assuming that it's impracticable. Slide. Now let's talk about inter-facility gathering lines. This has a long history. For those of you that are in the upstream sector, there has been a lot of concern, and obviously these can be a source of releases. We've been trying to work with the folks at API and other members of the upstream community on trying to get some minimum expectations. I think there were some concerns on what exactly was expected in these flow line maintenance programs. So what we did is we put a minimum set of expectations in the rule text, and those are that the flow line program must ensure the compatibility of the production fluids and the conditions expected with the operational. It requires you to do visual inspection or testing on the lines on a regular schedule. What's important here is we do not dictate a time frame, so that is up to you and the PE. However, when looking at that, it should be at a frequency that if you're choosing to use a contingency plan, as we mentioned in the earlier slide, that you could implement that contingency plan effectively. It requires corrective action and repairs for leaking equipment, and then removal of any oil that's spilled from this equipment. Slide. Flow-through process vessel. What is it? I know the people in the oil patch know what it is, but just for the purposes of the presentation and consistency, essentially it's the pieces of equipment at the production facility that's used to separate the fractions of oil and gas and water and put them in their, as I call it, being from Virginia and not in the oil patch, putting them in their different baskets. One goes to the stock, the oil goes to the stock tank, the produced water with the produced water, oil and water mixtures that make it through the separation process go to the produced water tank. Then, of course, gas is sent down through the sales line. These devices are the devices that perform that function of separation. And essentially what we're looking for is we provide an option to give some relief associated with these particular pieces of equipment. Currently, this equipment, as well as produced water tanks, is required to have size containment. Yes, I should have said slide. We're on slide 43. It says flow-through vessel requirements. What we've provided as an option, again, this is an option. If you have provided size containment, you don't have to do this. It's an option. However, you may choose to provide in lieu of size secondary containment, which means you would use general containment. You would have a system that looks very similar to flow lines and gathering lines, but essentially visual inspection and testing on a periodic basis, corrective action, prompt removal of oil that spilled, and the general containment requirements would still apply. Now, one of the things is you would be required to go back to size secondary containment if you had a discharge from this particular type of equipment at your facility, is what we call a bring back clause, within 6 months. So essentially, if your facility has a discharge from equipment, process equipment, you lose that ability to use this option. Slide. Okay, the definition of produced water container, essentially put this in the code to define produced water containers so you know the types of containers that would receive the relief that we were going to talk about here in a minute, and you can see the definition in front of you. Essentially, it's the container that's storing the oil water that makes it through the separation process, and it's usually a mixture of mostly brine water. It could be very minimal amounts of oil, or in some cases could be large amounts when in the case of an upset, as it's the last container in the process. Next slide. What is that alternative? The alternative for produced water containers, you have an alternative to size secondary containment similar to that option for flow-through process equipment. But essentially what you're doing is you're having a PE provide you relief from size secondary containment by designing a procedure to remove the oil or the free phase oil that's accumulating on that produced water tank and needs to be implemented on a regular schedule. Again, incorporates the concepts of conducting visual inspection, doing routine maintenance, and corrective action or cleaning up spill. The general provisions for containment still apply. It additionally has a what we would call a bring back clause. If you have a discharge from any of these produced water containers, 6 months, you would have to go back to size secondary containment. Next slide. Okay, the facility diagram requirement. We're out of production now and talking about this requirement, which is for everyone. And what we've done is we revised and clarified that the facility diagram must include only fixed containers, not mobile portable containers. This is the diagram. So for mobile portable containers, the diagram must show the area where these are generally stored And a description of the number of containers and an estimated content capacity discussion as opposed to a strict accounting. Now, for those folks that are near an FRP threshold, or more importantly, for the smaller facilities that may be near a 10,000-gallon threshold for applicability of the small facilities options, self-certification, this accounting becomes important. So you may not be putting it on your plan. You still have to describe it, and more importantly, that accounting, a 55-gallon drum could knock you out of self-certification, and a 55-gallon drum could even potentially kick you into FRP, I mean, if you had a lot of other storage. But the point being here is that accounting is important. We're just not trying to clog up a diagram with all these mobile portable containers and providing a little bit more relief in that area. Next slide. Revision of the general secondary containment requirement. This was codified as a result of some work that we had done in the inspector guidance document. And actually, I want to give a pitch for that right now. We answer quite a bit of phone calls, and we have a hotline number that we'll tell you about at the end of this presentation. But this is a pretty common question we get associated with general containment. And we had a lot of concerns over how things applied, and we wrote the inspector guidance document to address this and some other issues, and if you have an opportunity, you'll see at the end of this a link to our website that has the inspector guidance document, and that document has quite a bit of material in there that will help you with compliance. Just as a side note, we're currently working on updating that. So back to this, we had done some things in the guidance document that we wanted to codify, and essentially we clarified that the secondary containment requirement, the general requirement under 112.7c, is intended to address the most likely discharge of oil from the equipment at a facility. It allows the use of active or passive containment, active being something that you would implement in the event of a release. An example would be you had a loading-unloading area, not at a rack, but a loading and unloading area where you had a drain, and you wanted to put a mat either on the drain or over the drain before you were loading or unloading, or in the event of a spill, you were going to put it on the mat over the drain to contain discharges. That would be an example of an active measure, whereas passive would be some form of constructed containment. The other thing that this is trying to, we're trying to be clear on, because there's a considerable amount of misinformation, I'll put it that way, regarding secondary containment in the context of general. With this rule text, you don't have to build secondary containment. Now, it may be appropriate for you to build something and have a passive structure for general secondary containment, which is, it's a site-specific decision, but you also have the option to use an active measure. So, again, active measures will make sense when you have human intervention or somebody is there. Once you get into facilities that are unmanned or not, you don't have somebody there to implement the active measure. Obviously, an active measure isn't your best option. We also did some housekeeping and modified a couple of additional things in the list of types of prevention systems for onshore facilities. Slide. Non-transportation-related tanker trucks. What we have here is a kind of a housekeeping requirement, and without getting into a lot of details, the bottom line is in 2006, we provided relief from the size secondary containment requirements for tanker trucks that were specifically refuelers. Our friends from the electrical power industry and some other folks pointed out that, well, gee whiz, we have trucks that don't have fuel in it, dielectric fluid or lubrication oil. So that relief wouldn't apply to us. Essentially, this language is a way to reconcile that, and now all tanker trucks that are at a SPCC facility that are subject to the regulatory requirements are now have the general containment requirement as opposed to the size secondary containment requirement. It does not apply to mobile portable containers. The mobile portable containers are still required to have size secondary containment. Slide. Just for the purposes of making sure we're all on the same slide, you should be on security. Don't want to go into this too much because it's really old news. This is essentially 2008, 2009. We we're taking language that we had provided in 2006 for qualified facilities and extended to everybody. And essentially what we did is we gave a more performance-based standard for security. And so essentially this was, again, a housekeeping item to provide this to everyone. We got a lot of notes and comments suggesting this, and that's what we did. So we'll move on to the next slide. Same thing with integrity testing. I'll spend a little bit of time here, though. Again, the idea here was to fix some problems in the language that basically said you had to do a visual inspection and some other form of non-destructive testing. So that really set up a bad scenario for the industry in that a 55-gallon drum, which is considered a bulk storage container under the rule, would be subject to visual inspection and UT testing, which is, or some other form of non-destructive testing, which is, as you all know, pretty much overkill. We tried to do some things in guidance to help with that, but what really made things helpful was the development of a standard by the Steel Tank Institute. And essentially what it says is for certain of these smaller containers, you know, visual can work. Now, you're going to need to look at the standard itself and see how that applies, but certainly some of these smaller containers, a visual inspection is okay. But back to the global idea of integrity testing, essentially what we were doing here is changing the language to say that if you're complying with an industry standard, you're good to go. We don't require any longer visual and something else. It's only what's required by the standard. And again, this will have significant impact on smaller containers that are shop built, depending on how they fall out in the matrix that's provided under the SP001 document for inspection. One other thing we want to highlight, and that is environmental equivalence and how it relates to integrity testing. There are a lot of containers out there that we realize do not have standards. So if you don't have a standard, you're going to say to yourself, well, gee whiz, I can't comply with this provision. Well, that's exactly why we have environmental equivalence. And essentially what that allows you to do is you and the PE develop a specific inspection protocol, or what we call a hybrid testing program, to meet the needs of your facility or your particular container. For example, certain containers and certain services will not be able to utilize the SP001 standard because they're in an elevated temperature service. Next slide. And I'm going to try to wrap it up here in a couple minutes so we can do some Q&A for about a half an hour. So just bear with me. I'm going to buzz through 12 slides and then we'll take some Q&A. We have differentiated integrity testing requirements for animal fats and vegetable oils. This was as a result of looking at some differentiation possibilities as a result of the Edible Oil Reform Act, and we have a gentleman on staff that's been working diligently on that. And essentially, what we have is a set of requirements that allows for, by code, essentially it's an environmental equivalence option that's written into the code. So if you meet certain criteria, you get to do certain types of inspections. So next slide. What are those criteria? If you're an animal fat and vegetable oil tank that's subject to the Food and Drug Regulation 21 CFR 110, and you're elevated, you're made from austenitic stainless steel, no external insulation, and a shop built, you can basically do a visual inspection. What's notable here is large commodity tanks that are on the front end of that process to make a food, large above-ground storage tanks that are field-erected obviously would not meet this criteria. You basically, like I said, can use the existing criteria or have this option for environmental equivalence by code. Next slide. Now we're getting into clarifications very quickly. There's a number of things that we did just to kind of clarify things relative to components of the rule. And what we have is you'll see a picture of a nurse tank. And what we say is a nurse tank equates to a mobile refueler and then therefore gets the relief only required general secondary containment. Slide. This is significant and deserves a couple minutes of time, and that is the UST oil transfer clarification. I believe it resides in the preamble somewhere around the loading and unloading rack discussion. And basically what this is to clarify, well, it's to correct a preamble problem in 2006. And basically what this says is at an otherwise regulated facility, if you have underground storage tanks, so in other words, if you're an SPCC facility, you have an underground storage tank, there are components of that underground storage tank that are not part of the underground storage tank system and are not subject to 280. Those would be the dispensers and, in some cases, at military operations, loading racks that are attached to underground storage tanks. What this clarification says is these transfers are regulated under the FPCC program at an otherwise regulated facility. Now, if you're at a facility that only has USTs and you are not regulated by the FPCC program, obviously this wouldn't apply. It's only when you break the threshold and are regulated, while the underground storage tanks may be exempt because of the 280 exemption, which takes them out of our rule, the transfers and that equipment associated with that may be subject to the rule depending on, again, the type of equipment. So in the case of a loading rack attached to an underground storage tank, it would be subject to 112.7H, and then other transfers would be associated with 112.7C. So the idea here is dispensers, the drop bucket, can easily be dealt with a spill kit. It's not a big expectation here because, again, you define what the type of spill is going to be. And I think we all know the type of spills that are associated with dispensers. Slide. Definition of permanently closed. Essentially, this was mainly to address some confusion in the production sector, but there is one component that was for farming. And essentially what it says is you have certain things you need to do for permanently closing a tank, but you do not have to remove the container from your facility. So that has some implications for the production facility folks. For folks outside the production patch, again, you can take a tank, permanently close it, and not remove it. However, there may be local code requirements that require you to remove the container from the facility grounds or demolish it if it's a field-constructed container. So, again, you'll need to consult with your local code official. The other thing that we have in there is that for the purposes of production, these permanent closure requirements have nothing to do with your Subtitle C RCRA requirements. So production, we're exempt from that. There's really no tie-in between the two, and there was some confusion about that. And then finally, we made a point to say that a brand new container that has never stored oil that comes on, that you bring onto your facility, as long as never stored oil, would not be counted towards your threshold. Once it contains oil, it would be counted towards your threshold unless it was permanently closed. Slide. This is an interesting one. Man-made structures. Essentially what we say in this clarification is that a man-made structure may be utilized as containment. The big warning that we give you is we've had a number of cases where people utilize the building for containment and have not properly research the drainage and their drains that end up allowing a discharge to reach navigable waters. But if the walls of a building may be used in a drainage system as containment, you can do that. Man-made structures can be used for containment. However, man-made structures are not an option for you to get out of SPCC applicability. So we don't allow you to say, I'm out of the rule because this is inside of a building. We say that you may use the building for containment. Slide. Wind turbines, essentially, these are popping up all over. I know that there's a considerable amount of facilities associated with this. I know Florida Light and Power has quite a few now. These wind turbines are defined as oil field operational equipment, and in a 2006 rule, you'll know that that provides them with an option, which is a contingency plan option in lieu of general containment. And then they also, the way they're designed, may be set up in a way that they actually provide containment for the reservoirs of oil contained within the device. Now, that's a site-specific determination, but essentially wanted to point that out. Slide. Natural gas and oil facilities. I noticed that there's some folks on here from Colonial and other folks from the pipeline sector. Essentially, what we're clarifying in this 2009 action is that we are going to continue to work with DOT We'll be involved with FERC future discussions with them. And we really wanted to do it outside this notice and comment, I mean, this particular action, because it was way beyond the scope of what we were trying to do here. The internet operators have questioned for years this whole issue of DOT and EPA regulatory requirements and where they overlap at complexes. We provided a memorandum in 2000 that kind of defined and showed the relationship of DOT and EPA jurisdiction. And there's been some concerns about that memo and dual regulatory requirements. And what our goal is to continue to work with DOT PISMA to provide clarification and to to minimize dual regulation where is appropriate. And what we mean by that is where there's regulatory parity between EPA and DOT. Slide. You can go to the next slide. This is just the wrap-up. Just wanted to give you a quick reminder that for the purposes of outreach, you are required by 40 CFR Part 110 to report oil spills to the NRC, the numbers in front of you. It is manned by the U.S. Coast Guard. You're required to do that in an immediate fashion. That links into our response network of OSCs and then gets the words out to other partners and stakeholders in the response community. Slide. The other reporting requirements that you should be aware of and that are often overlooked are those associated with the FPCC rule. And actually, let me stop there. I should mention that the NRC reporting requirement under 110 is what we call the Sheen rule, and what that means is the reportable quantity, unlike under CERCLA, which does things in pounds, it's a visual test of a sheen. But in addition to a sheen, there's a number of other factors. It can be a sheen, emulsion, violating a water quality standard. You can refer to 110 for those reporting requirements, but realize that it's different and that it's not in pounds. Next, back to slide 61. There are requirements for reporting in the SPCC rule that are above and beyond your requirement to report to the NRC. These are found in 112.4A. And if you're a SPCC facility and you have a spill, you're required to report to the regional administrator certain information. You used to be required to submit your whole plan. You're not. Regulatory relief in 2002 was to minimize what you had to submit to the RA. But you have to submit certain information for discharges greater than 1,000 gallons or 242-gallon discharges within a 12-year block of time. Now, within a calendar, 12-year, I said 12 months. Yeah, boy, everyone's jumping up and down. 12-month period of time. And that's a rolling block. That is not a year. It's just a 12-month period. Next slide. And I think that is our last slide, which asks you to take a look at, write down these different websites. One of the things, we have two websites on there for the EPA emergency management. The official website is epa.gov/emergency. A quick way to get to a lot of the SPCC materials, including these slides, is www.epa.gov/oil spill. It also, if you go to that link, you click on the SPCC requirements, you will be able to access these slides, which we have in a format that you can modify at your own risk, of course, to fit your needs for presentations. We will also have other materials as we develop them to assist you with outreach on the website. So keep a good bookmark there and watch it on a routine basis. And again, probably the first thing you're going to want to look for is the templates that will go up fairly soon. The last thing that I wanted to mention is just a quick update on the guidance document. We're currently working on updating that to look at all the comments that we got in. We got, looking at them right now, we got some phenomenally good comments from the regulated community and suggestions on the guidance document, and I think you will see that we're going to incorporate a number of them into the revision of the guidance document. The design is to get a document that will address the 2006, 8, and 9 requirements sometime later next year. Don't know exact time period. Depends on some other factors. So we still have this extension to get out, and we have some other things we've got to work on template. But we are working on it actively. And then finally, one of the things just to keep, I know a lot of people are frustrated with trying to get a hold of myself. not so much Patty, she's better at answering the phone than I am, or Vanessa, is we are bombarded with phone calls, and it's difficult for us to, you know, work on all these other things and answer all these phone calls, and a majority of these calls could be answered by the hotline. And if they can't, they get sent right to us. So please utilize the hotline if you have the opportunity. They're very good, and if there's any questions that they can't answer or interpretations, it comes directly to us. So with that, I'd like to close out. Thank you for your time and attention and open it up for questions.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Mark. We've had a number of questions that have been submitted online throughout the presentation, and I'm sure we still have a number of people that are on the phone that would like to ask questions. So, again, we'll still continue on for the next 20 minutes or so, just addressing Q&A with the instructors as well as some additional speakers. What I'm going to do is I'm going to start right now and take a few questions that were submitted earlier online, and then we'll bounce back to the phone lines. So those of you on the phone, hang tight. We'll get to you in just a second. And at that time, you guys are welcome to take your phone off of mute. When we get time for the phone questions, you'll simply hit your own mute button or hit #6 to take yourself off of mute to ask a question. But for right now, let's start with a question that came in online from Colorado. And they ask, at production facilities, produced water is sometimes stored in pits, ponds, or lagoons. These units are constructed in the ground by excavation and then the forming up of berms. Are these units produced water container units, or are they, basically they're asking because they can't find a definition of a container in Part 112?
Right. Generally we would consider the produced water pits produced water containers, yes. Now obviously there are some difficulties in meeting some of the requirements, and that's where, for integrity testing, that's where environmental equivalence would come into play for those unique pits.
Okay, great. The next question comes in from North Carolina, and they ask, is secondary containment now required where a tanker truck loads fuel to an above-ground storage tank where this is not a loading rack?
As we had mentioned, and I think the question, and just so you know, as I mentioned yesterday when we did the dry run, I'm having a real trouble hearing you. So I think the question was, if you have basically a transfer area that's not a loading rack, is secondary containment required? And the answer is, at a otherwise regulated facility, yes, but the type of containment that was that would be required would be general, so you have a lot of flexibility in determining the sizing and the method of containment used for that kind of transfer operation.
Okay, great. The next question that I'm going to take online comes from California, and they ask, are construction sites with diesel fuels covered?
Are construction sites with diesel fuel covered? It's a little tricky question, but I'll give you an example where it is, and that there's a lot of different variations of this. But if you have a construction site where you're working on road and working on a road project, and you're there, let's say, there for a year, and you set up a fueling operation to fuel the equipment to move around that facility, and you break the threshold, that is considered, you know, non-transportation related storage. So, yes, it would be if the facility is storing an oil, met the other applicability requirements, such as reasonable expectation that the spill or discharge reach water to the United States, and you're storing an oil, and you're breaking the threshold of 1320 above ground or 42,000 above ground. I mean, below ground, excuse me.
Okay. The next question that I'm going to take online, because we do have a bunch of them coming in, is coming in from Syracuse, New York, and they ask, what is the status of vegetable oils? They were included in 2002, but then they were going to be removed.
Could you repeat the last part of that question?
They basically say, what is the status of vegetable oils? They were included in 2002, but then were going to be removed.
Okay. I think that's some confusion relative to some actions that we took removing some things in 2006. Animal fats and vegetable oils are included in the applicability or are considered an oil for the purposes of the FPCC rule. We never removed them from the FPCC rule. What the question may be getting to is, in 2006, we removed provisions that didn't make sense for animal fat and vegetable oils, and that was an embarrassing thing where we had requirements for animal fat and vegetable oil for drill rigs, and there are no such thing as animal fat and vegetable oil drill rigs, but that was actually an outgrowth of a notice and comment issue and us being consistent. We had to do that. So to recap, animal fats and vegetable oils are regulated by the rule. And again, to emphasize that would be that we made changes and provided the environmental equivalence option and code for animal fats and vegetable oils, and that resides in 112.12.
Okay. I'm going to take one more question online, and we're going to go bounce over to the phone lines, and then we'll come back to the online questions. The next question comes in from Alabama, and they say, based on the definition of a facility, an owner could divide a contiguous facility operating, I think they're saying, 3 500-gallon tanks into 3 facilities and eliminate the need for an SPCC plan. Is that true? But it might be 3,500-gallon tanks. I think he means 3 500-gallon tanks, though.
Well, if it's... Well, let me just explain a couple scenarios. And if you're going to have let's say you have a discrete location, a facility with 3 500-gallon tanks, you're going to say each one of those is a facility. That probably wouldn't. That is not an appropriate use of the term facility. You can't divide out facilities by container. If what you're saying is you have 3 locations around a city, each have 500 gallons. Not required to combine those, and so those would be individual facilities, each with a 500-gallon container and not subject to the requirement.
Okay. We're going to just switch gears and stop in and take a quick second with the people who are still on the phone lines. If you have a question for the instructor, feel free to take your phone off of mute and ask the question out loud. I'm just going to take 2 or 3 questions from the phone lines now. If you've muted your phone with our command, you want to hit #6. Unmute.
I have a question about the loading racks.
Go ahead.
On the slide, I've got a situation where we have a fixed pipe that we use to unload rail cars, and we don't have any other connections other than we will bring in a flexible hose, connect it to the rail car, and connect it to that fixed pipe, and then do the unloading that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to understand the discussion with the flexible pipe, and it sounded like from the discussion you said that would not constitute a loading rack, but the way I read the slide, it almost indicated it would.
Well, that slide is mainly getting at bottom loading because that's where there was for tanker trucks. I would have to see... I'm not going to make a regulatory call on something that I haven't seen, but what it sounds like to me is you don't have a loading arm. If there's no loading arm present, it would not be a loading rack. But what I will be more than happy to do, snap a picture of it, send it to me, and we can discuss this later.
Okay, that's fine. But, yeah, correct. There is no arm, nothing movable. It's just a fixed pipe.
Yeah, if... And again, I'm qualifying this because I haven't seen it. I've just been in the government too long. You know, I've got to qualify everything. But no, once I take a look at it, I'm sure it won't be an issue. But if it does not contain a loading arm, then it's only subject to 112.7C, which again provides you a lot of flexibility. And also, you know, it'd be useful too is if you have any suggestions on rewriting that slide that has confusion, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.
Next.
Then feel free, go ahead. If you've muted your lines, simply hit the unmute button or hit #6 to unmute.
This is from New York. If you have a residential dwelling that has an above-ground storage tank that's greater than 1,350 gallons because it's an estate, would that be regulated?
If it meets the exemption, which is if it's a heating oil for heating oil tank for residential property, it's exempt from the rules, but it has to be a single-family home. So,
thank you.
Limitations.
Okay, one more question on the phone lines, and then we'll switch back to the online questions.
So I could really get myself into trouble. I was getting ready to do some kind of a joke about the Tiger Woods, but I won't. About the state. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I don't hear anything. Again, we'll come back to the phone lines in just a minute. We're going to go through, because we do have a number of online questions. I'm going to go with the next question that comes in from Texas, and I think you may have already addressed this one. They ask you to clarify the definition of a loading or unloading arm. With swivel joints, does that count as a loading arm, or and without it does not?
Okay, the slide that everyone's referring to is 29, and again, specifically, and to give you some background on this, I spent a lot of time working with the folks on the industry on this, because it's hard to define the loading rack without this loading arm. And essentially what we're talking about is, and I hate to repeat text that's in there, but I just don't want to move from this language, is it's an arm that's a movable pipe assemblage that can be a combination of fixed or flexible piping. Now, with top loading, you typically see, I say top loading, a top loading vehicle, you see two pieces of piping that are connected by a swivel joint. What you see on a bottom loader, for a tank truck at least, is you'll see that the swivel is essentially at the top of the loading rack where there is, you know, hard pipe, and then there's a flex hose that allows the operator to maneuver that loading arm into position to lock into the tanker truck. Those are specifically the types of things that we see as loading and unloading arms. And again, I would refer you to the slide after that. It gives you two examples of loading and unloading arms. And what would also be useful too, you've got my email. If you've got pictures of stuff that you have and you want us to look at whether it's a loading rack or not, it would also provide examples that we could provide in guidance whether or not something is a loading rack or not with, you know, pictures. So that would be a big help to us. But the answer would, again, I'm just telling you what we've already put in preamble. So, and I don't want to go any further from that. That's what a loading arm is. And you'll find that in the preamble to the 2008 rule. There's a lot more detail than what's in this slide.
Okay. The next question online comes in from Michigan, and they ask, what does sized secondary containment mean?
Ah, you know, Patty's probably smiling right now because I use this lingo and I shouldn't. Okay. The terms that we have kind of used all the time is sized or general containment. What that really means is under 112.7C, you're required to have general containment, which is something where you're predicting the size of spill that you have to contain. Size secondary containment, however, is where the owner-operator, by code, is told how to size the containment structure. So, for an example, size containment requirements are such like the bulk storage containers. They're required to have secondary containment size for the largest container, or for rain events. That would be an example of a sized secondary containment requirement. The other term we also use is specific, because it, depending on the type of facility, it defines what kind of specific requirements you have. And then finally, another example would be a loading rack. You have a specific sized secondary containment requirement for the largest tank on a rail or tanker truck. So, again, it's where the code is specifically defining the sizing that's required for containment.
Okay, the next question comes in from California, and they say, so as I understand it, when a tank truck comes to my facility to load an emergency generator, that flexible hose, and loading truck, they do not need passive secondary containment. And that simple active containment is putting a mat over a drain is acceptable.
Aha! Trying to pin me on my words. That's not exactly correct. You have a number of options. Again, I don't know what your facility looks like, but it doesn't automatically say that active is okay. But in the case of where you're transferring to a, well, first of all, when the tanker truck comes on site and is transferring to an emergency generator tank. First, the facility has to be regulated, so I'm assuming that it's regulated. But that transfer into the container is typically not done across a loading rack, so that means it's only subject to the 112.7C general containment requirements. Now, you'll see from the slides that you have two options, active or passive. Passive is probably the best fail-safe way for you to design something. You could use active measures, which includes putting a mat down before or after the spill. I can tell you this, you'll look in our inspector guidance, your ability to implement that active measure becomes something that we look at. So is it an option for you to use? Yes, it's depending on site-specific factors that you'll need to evaluate. But the idea is you need to implement what you're saying you're going to do. Now, here's the issue with the scenario you've described is, does the tanker truck operator have the mat that is going to do what you say they're going to do? And since it's a third party, do they even have any responsibility to do it? So if there's a member of your facility there during the transfer that knows where that active measure is located that could implement it, it certainly makes sense. But it's, again, active measures are a great way to address things, but you certainly have to be able to implement them, and that's why by providing this flexibility, we want you to be able to use that, but at the same time, when we evaluate compliance, we want to make sure you can implement what you say you're going to do. So I hope that helps.
Okay, great. We're going to do a few more questions for online. The next question, I'm going to take one from California again, and they ask, is 42 U.S. gallons exempt from reporting?
It's 42 gallons exempt from reporting. I'm going to take that for two things. 42 gallons, I think the number, and there's some confusion there, that when it comes to reporting under 40 CFR 110, which is your basic oil spill requirement for reporting, the criteria is a sheen. The 42 gallons comes into play with the SPCC rule, and basically what that says is if you have discharges of 42 gallons within a certain period of time, then you have to report to the agency. So that 42 gallons is a trigger for two 42 gallons or greater events within a year period. That's for only your SPCC reporting requirements. For the purposes of compliance with your general reporting requirements for oil spills, that again goes back to the harm criteria under 110, which is a sheen or a number of other criteria. So, again, since I don't know how that was phrased, if it was phrased to SPCC or to the overall reporting requirement, I hope that clarifies the question.
Okay, the next one's coming in from Virginia. They ask, did you say that EPA was going to be developing a Tier 2 template in addition to the Tier 1 template currently found in Appendix G?
First of all, I'd like to say hello to my folks in Virginia, my home state. We are looking at our main priority right now, again, is getting the original, the Tier 1 templates on the web to be filled out. Tier 2 template, we're looking at doing something along those lines. But remember, essentially, a Tier 2 template is essentially an SPCC plan because the only difference between a Tier 2 facility and a PE a certified plan is that, the PE certification, so all the requirements are there. It certainly would, we kind of have that already in that the inspector guidance has currently has a sample plan, but that may be something that we would consider in the long term. I mean, actually, Patty, you want to jump in? We have something in the hopper on this, don't we?
Yes, we currently have a the Tier 1 template that is in the Federal Register publication, we will have that available. We are also developing a sample Tier 2 plan and a template that could be used. However, that is really more along the lines of guidance. Individuals have a lot of flexibility with whether or not they want to use that, adjust the language, or create their own self-certified plan.
Great, thanks, Patty. So obviously, we've got some things in the hopper, but again, we're releasing things by priority, and right now to get that Tier 1 template out, get work on the extension, get the guidance out, and then down the road, there may be some pretty neat tools that we develop down the road. But again, office of four people, it's a little, you know, four or five of us, we're limited in how much we can do immediately, so. Again, we're going to have to prioritize, but thanks for the question.
Okay, another question coming in from California. They ask, if several companies lease and occupy a facility and the total exceeds 1,320 gallons, who is responsible for filing an SPCC plan?
Great question. If you go to the applicability of the rule, it says owner or operator. So, it really depends on the operation. Now, if you have multiple facilities that add up and there's one owner of the building, an argument could be made that that is a owner owns a property that has a capacity threshold. If the individual leaseholders have capacity, you may be able to make an argument for them being separate facilities. Again, because I don't have the specificity of the location, I'm not going to say yes or no, but again, the definition of facility provides some flexibility. And to provide a concrete example would be one of like an airport. There are airports that have people that lease pieces of property, rental car facilities, and so forth, and they could certainly say that the airport authority has SPCC responsibility for all their containers, and then the rental car has responsibility for their containers. But essentially, it really boils down to the owner-operator. But what I will warn, I tell everyone, it's the Richard Franklin kind of cautionary word, is that as an owner-operator of a facility, if you have a spill, you both can be held liable for the spill portion. So trying to put together an SPCC plan for facilities holding these products is a good idea, in that both of you are potentially have a liability under responsibility for cleanup and remediation of any oil spill. So, prevention, the old ounce of prevention is a good idea.
Okay. We're coming up just on 3 o'clock Eastern time, which is our scheduled stop time. We do have a number of questions that were submitted online, and I know we still have people on the phones. So I think I'm going to extend this by another 5 minutes to continue with the Q&A, if that's okay with the instructors.
Yep.
And just kind of go through the last few questions I have online. The next one comes in from Arizona, and they ask, can you please define the term immediate when submitting RQ discharge reports to the NRC? Is there a specific time frame, such as 15 minutes or 1 hour, which is the same as CERCLA?
I'm going to pass on that particular question. It's really out of my area of expertise. But the code says immediate, and I'm not going to elaborate on what that means. That person will keep in contact with their attorney, because it really outside my area of expertise.
Okay. The next question is going to come in from Ohio, and they ask, is a 55-gallon drum that is stored inside a building but may be moved to various locations within the building subject to the size secondary containment requirements of a bulk storage container or the general secondary containment requirements?
That's a good question. The fact that it's in a building really doesn't change its requirements that apply to the drum. It is considered by the code a bulk storage container. Bulk storage container have the size secondary containment requirements, which prescribe that you must provide containment for the large containers for freeboard for a rain event. The good news is we did clarify that you don't have to consider freeboard if size containment if it's inside of a building, obviously, because there's no rain. But the answer to the question is yes, you would have to consider containment for the size of that drum because it is a bulk container. Now, could you use the building for containment? Absolutely, but again, the cautionary word is make sure you know about the drainage and how the drainage operates in the building.
Okay. The next question comes in from Pennsylvania, and they ask, is a regulated UST pump considered a loading rack? In parentheses, it has a flexible hose, and therefore needs to comply with 40 CFR 112.7H?
Okay. I'm going to repeat this because I want to make sure I got it right. Is a UST, a regulated UST with a gas pump, dispenser considered a loading rack? I'm paraphrasing, but that's generally the question?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. That flexible hose has no loading arm. So typically, a dispenser doesn't meet the definition of a loading rack. Therefore, the only requirement, and I think I highlighted this when we talked about this clarification, would be that you would have to, it would be subject to 112.7C. So in the case of this dispenser, if it was located in an otherwise regulated SPCC facility, in other words, there were other containers that broke the threshold, your only regulatory requirement there is just to have a general containment method And, you know, a lot of folks, it would be fairly easily addressed by putting sorbent kits, clean up spills. And again, I think we know the types of spills that occur at dispensers. So to answer the question, no, it's not a loading rack.
Okay.
As long as it does not have a loading.
Okay. And the next question, next 2 weeks are going to come in from Alabama. They asked you to please clarify the integrity testing requirement. Is an owner required to identify these themselves, and if so, where would they look?
Good question. Integrity testing requirement is for bulk containers. It does not apply to oil field operational equipment or oil field equipment. It only applies to bulk containers. Now, that's a range anywhere from a drum all the way to a fuel-directed tank. So that being said, I'm going to highlight two of the major provision, major codes that would help an owner-operator. And again, I want to reference Chapter 7 of our inspector guidance, which has an extremely detailed list of these other standards that you could look at. But first would be for fuel-directed tanks, it would be API 653. And for shop-built tanks, would be ST-001. There are a number of other standards for certain types of containers, fiberglass, that are listed in the inspector guidance. And then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, if there is no standard, then the PE can develop what we call a hybrid integrity testing program. And there is significant guidance in Chapter 7 on the minimum expectations of that type of program and what you would need to put in a hybrid integrity testing program. As far as where you would go, both of those agencies, I believe it's steeltank.org, but you'll have to put that into Google. But it's the Steel Tank Institute, and then the second one is the American Petroleum Institute, would be two main resources. They're not the only ones, but those are two that you may want to take a look at. And then again, look at Chapter 7 of our guidance.
Okay. The next one asks, again, coming out of Alabama, what is the threshold storage capacity which triggers the FRP requirement?
I'm going to look to Richard or Patty on that one. This is an FRP question. You want to get it, Richard?
Okay.
Go ahead.
So the question again, this is Richard Franklin again, it's the what triggers the threshold capacity?
For FRP.
For FRP. So you would have to meet, you know, it's a subset typically of SPCC regulations, so you have to meet the criteria where reasonable expectation to get to navigable waters of the United States or adjoining shoreline. There's a chart in the FRP regulations which lays this out. I think it's in Appendix C, maybe. You have to have 1 million gallons and meet some other criteria, typically for storage, or 52,000 gallons of storage and you transfer in bulk to or from a vessel over water. So those are the basics. I would look to that flow chart. There's some other criteria that goes along with that, but typically that's 1 million gallons and some other criteria. And so as Mark mentioned earlier, that may have special significance for the production sector with produced water tanks, which hold oil and are viewed as tanks or containers which hold oil. And so their capacity could add up depending on how you define facility. Just throw someone over into FRP, or you may decide based on operational factors not to combine a whole quite a big bunch of units, production tanks, so that it doesn't become FRP, but it needs to make operational sense.
Okay, great. Thanks. The final question that we're going to take, and then we'll close things out here today. It's going to come in from Georgia, and they ask, in regard to clarifying the EPA DOT jurisdiction issues, how will this information be relayed, in parentheses, in the inspector guidance, an MOU, or a memo? And is there a proposed schedule for the issuance, in parentheses, before November 10th, 2010?
Let me guess. Georgia, Atlanta, Colonial Pipeline. That's a guess. Good question. We have not decided on the mechanism to, on exactly how we would be, getting that information out yet. We will continue to work with, the Office of Pipeline, PISMA. Schedule is, again, we're trying to fit it in with some of the other things that we're doing, so there's no hard and fast schedule yet, but it is something that we're going to be working on with DOT. It's kind of a non-answer because we want to get some of this initial implementation things done, but it's something that we will continue to work with our sister agency on, or department, on, again, doing what we can to clarify the 2000 MOU, 2000 letter of agreement or letter that we did on jurisdiction.
Okay. Well, with that, it's about 3:08, and I think we're going to close things out here today. I'm going to direct everybody to the actual final slide that would have been available in the online version, which should be slide number 64. And on that final slide, you'll see two additional references that I mentioned at the start of today's presentation. The first one being a link to additional resources where you'll be able to download today's slides as well as a number of other documents and websites that are related to today's talk. And then the second link on slide 64 is our feedback form, which should only take you about a minute or two to complete. If any of you are looking for confirmation of your participation today, upon submitting the feedback form, there's a box that you can check when you fill that out to ask for an email confirmation to be sent to you so you can keep that for your records. If you're interested in CDUs or PDHs, sometimes having that confirmation email along with a copy of the slides and your registration email, sometimes that'll help with the accreditation body to get credit for this type of an event. So after directing everyone there to the feedback form, I just want to extend my thanks to the organizers as well as to these instructors, the people at OSC Readiness who put together this session as well as a number of others in the series, and our instructors today here from EPA as well as those who are available to assist with questions. I also want to extend my thanks to all of the members of the audience who sat in on our seminar today and asked questions and communicated with the instructors. I know we didn't have enough time to cover everybody's questions today, so the instructors' email addresses as well as mine are available on the seminar homepage, and you also saw them in the print materials today as well. So you're welcome to contact either Mark or me or Patty if you have questions and would like to have follow-up comments. So again, I'd like to thank everyone for participating and joining us today. And I hope that I'll see you all on a future Clue and Internet seminar. This will conclude today's event. Thank you, and have a wonderful afternoon.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Goodbye.